This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
Lesser known teachings. One of the things that's happening now, really in our generation, for the first time, in some ways, for the first time in most of Buddhist history, as lay people and lay people, non-monastics, but even in the monastic community, we now have access to good, readable translations of the Pali Canon that even many of our teachers, my teachers in the Insight Meditation tradition, Jack Kornfield and Sylvia Borstein and others, when they began their practice, didn't really have access to. There were these awkward translations from the Pali Text Society that filled up, you know, massive amounts of real estate on the bookshelf, and were hard to get through, hard to find their way through, and not well indexed. And anyway, almost nobody had a copy of them, right? So even throughout Buddhist Asia, only some monastics who focused on study would have access to the bulk of the canon. And so when our teachers studied with the various Asian teachers in the Thai Forest tradition, Burmese Vipassana traditions in Sri Lanka and India, the teachings they got were the teachings that their teachers offered, whatever it was. And in many ways, for instance, the lists that we've memorized and have come down to us, the core teachings, are indeed a relatively small basket of teachings compared to what's out there. And one of the inspirations Shaila told me for this series was the recent publication of a new translation of the numbered discourses, the Anguttara Nikaya, from Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. And many of us, myself included, when it came out, got it. And whenever I would get one of these, you know, from when I first got the Majjhima Nikaya many years ago, and then the Sanyutta, and then the Digha, the long discourses, the linked discourses, and now these, I have this moment of amazement where I'm like, I'm just this like kind of suburban kid from California who, you know, who kind of liked meditation and got into it. And now I have like almost the entire Pali Canon actually in two different translations, just there on my bookshelf, right? More than some of the most serious teachers in centuries have had access to this. So it feels like quite a privilege that, you know, I can just get some idea. I can be like, hey, what does the canon say about such and such? And you know, and spend a happy evening just pulling books off the shelf and reading. And it's really quite precious. So one of the things we find in this new translation of the Anguttara, but throughout the canon is teachings that were relatively underemphasized, that may have been emphasized by various Asian teachers in their original incarnations, but that didn't thrive in the Western transmission. And so the invitation was for several of us to come and teach while Shaila was away, bringing in our sort of choices for what would be good lesser taught teachings. So tonight I want to speak about a pair of Pali words, a pair of qualities called hiri and otapa. And they're not invisible in the canon. They're actually quite common in the teachings. But they didn't get a lot of airtime when I was doing a lot of retreat and study. And I think the main reason they didn't get a lot of sort of heavy rotation in the Western teachings is that they're generally translated as shame and dread. So I'm here to talk to you tonight about shame and dread. And of course, as a Californian, you know, in the era of Brené Brown and the anti-shame self-empowerment world, one might think that these would be negative qualities, shame and dread, things to excise from my personality so that I could be a more confident member of the, you know, capitalist marketplace. But instead, these are called by the Buddha two bright qualities, two bright qualities. In another place, the canon calls them the guardians of the world, the guardians of the world. So Hiri and Ottapa, they're always spoken of together. They're sometimes, the old translation is moral shame and moral dread. So we're here talking about ethics, essentially. A parallel translation, however, that I rather like is conscience and concern. Conscience and concern. And if conscience and concern had been the primary translations, maybe we would have heard more about these things, right, than shame and dread. So these are qualities that are part of the gradual path, and they refer to an attitude of reflective or considering the nature of action, my own actions, others' actions, the actions of my community. And they refer to, in a sense, an orientation to two aspects of considering actions. Hiri, translated as conscience or moral shame, refers to the reflection on my own, I'll speak first in the individual stream, my own past actions, and particularly a sense of, we could say, healthy regret for past unskillful ethical actions. So if you've practiced for some time, particularly if you've sat intensive retreat, or if you're just a mature adult who's been around for a while, which it looks like many of you are, you may well have had a sitting, or 10, or several hundred, where you sit down and things seem to be going well, and then suddenly the past, right, blossoms in your heart in a painful way. I remember sittings where the entire sitting really just became a litany of all the stupid things I said, right? Starting at about the age of 12. Probably because I just sort of forgave myself as a child. Like, oh, well, I wouldn't have known any better. But once I became a teenager, then I was like, then you're just a jerk, right? And then I was mean to my mom. I was mean to, you're just like, oh. And then, you know, and then I start dating and it gets worse. So then the sitting becomes this kind of life review, right? We talk about. And at a certain point, to be honest, it got distilled down to simply a list of names of people I'd dated. Well, there was that one, and that went wrong in this way. There was this one that went wrong in this way. Oh my God, why did I do that? You know. And it's kind of this, we speak of it as a manifestation of the mind kind of proliferating in thoughts. Papancha is the term for proliferating thinking. The mind gets a little seed of, oh no, and then that seed sprouts into a great beanstalk that goes up to the heavens and there's Freudian father killing and all sorts of things, you know, in that story. And it is an aspect of mental proliferation. So then we get this quality, hiri, that says it's appropriate to reflect on past actions and past unskillful actions, akusala, unskillful or unwholesome actions, as long as what's happening is that I'm generating this powerful quality of remorse, of regretting my actions, and it comes along with otapa, moral dread, or concern for the future, right? May I not act like that in the future? So in a sense, right, moral shame and moral dread, they sound terrible. They are actually this beautiful quality of being connected to our own actions in time. Right? I have acted this way in the past. Here's how it was challenging. Please may I not act that way in the future. So it's a reflective awareness of action and its results. In the one hand, directed toward the past, and the other directed toward the future. And there's a hopefulness toward the future, encased within a healthy fear, right? Dread of unskillful action. So this has a couple implications. One of them certainly is in the basic intention that's at the heart of cultivation of this path, which is the intention toward wise action, right? And the whole limb or the multiple limbs of the path devoted to sila, or ethical action, right? The limbs of right or wise action, right or wise speech, right or wise livelihood. And there's that beautiful discourse from the Majjhima, more well-known, so it's not a lesser-known teaching, it's a greater-known teaching, the teaching to Rahula, where the Buddha's own son, Rahula, has apparently lied. Because in the beginning of the discourse, the Buddha says, essentially, Rahula, what is there that's worse than a deliberate lie? Nothing, you know. And you know, the kid is 8 years old. As we at least that's the sense we get from the commentaries and where it lives in the young boy's life. So this is a stern talking to from, you know, when your dad is the Buddha, really. You know, and you're just a little novice monk, right? You want to behave well, right? So he gets a talking to about lying, and then the Buddha goes into a teaching that says, Rahula, here's how you should practice. Before you do an action, you should reflect, is this action, do I think this action is going to have good results? Is this going to lead to my own well-being, the well-being of others, not harm anyone? And if your intuition says, yes, it's going to lead to well-being and not harm anyone, then go for it. While you're doing the action, you should reflect, is this action that I'm doing bringing well-being to myself and others, not causing harm? And if so, carry on doing it. And after you do the action, you should reflect in hindsight, how was it? Did it cause harm? Did it do well? So another version of a sense that... you know, this is not a meditation teaching that says one should only be present, for instance, which we get a lot, right? Just be present. Just be mindful in the present moment. This is actually an aspect of practice that is cognitive and reflective. Think about your past. Think about the future. Generate the feeling of remorse for past unskillful actions and generate a healthy aversion even to performing those actions in the future. So it resonates on one level as some of the motor or the fuel for the practice of sila or ethical action. And I think it has some other implications as well. One of them is that because it's looking at the past and the future, it's pointing to karma or kamma in the Pali. And the principle of kamma is that all phenomena, in a certain way, everything conditioned, has come into being based on causes and conditions, and in its existence also gives rise to future causes, is a condition for future arisings, right? So the way the formula for this is presented is because of this, this is. Right, because of this, this arises. When this is, that is. Because when this is gone, that ceases. Because of this, that is not. And this is sort of the shorthand for the grand teaching called dependent origination, which is a tangent. I'm not going to go into it tonight, but it's beautiful teaching about how not just how suffering comes to be, but really how our experience of ourselves comes to be based on craving, based on clinging, based on confused contact with the sensory world. And it speaks to the process of conditionality over time. This action leads to this result. And this is part of the traditional understanding of kamma or karma. Karma is the Sanskrit, kamma is the Pali. I'll sort of weave back and forth between the two. The sense being that at the heart of our practice is a respect for the truth of conditionality. In a way, if conditionality were not the truth or not the law of nature, practice wouldn't be effective. It wouldn't be possible, actually, to change course from being a suffering being to being a liberated being, right? That changing course or that cultivating practice is a process of intentional actions taken, right, that have results. That practice is also in response to our present condition, our condition of being not free. And that condition itself is the conditioned result of past actions. So this plays out in a bunch of ways. One is in the sense that my current, we could say, state or mind state is a result of a set of conditions. So right now, I'm relatively happy. I'm talking about the Dhamma. I love the Dhamma. How did I get here, right? I partly got here because I came down to interview Shaila for my dissertation several months ago. And I'm writing part of the dissertation on jhana. She's good at it. I came down to talk to her to say, hey, when you do this, what does it feel like? Da, 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 da. I asked her. We had a great conversation. She said, oh, this was a really fun conversation. Come teach my group when I'm away. I said, okay, that's great. So that's one condition. But that was based on the conditions of my having, you know, been practicing for 20 years and really loving practice. Oh, I really love practice. That's a condition that led to my choosing that dissertation topic, that led to my coming here, that led to my being here right now. But why did I practice? I partly practiced because after college, I hitchhiked around the country and I didn't know what I was doing and I was totally miserable. And I landed at this Zen center in the mountains of New Mexico, partly because that summer I had hitchhiked through Santa Fe and met a girl and she was nice, so I stayed. And then it was really nice for about 2 months and then it stopped being nice. And at the same time, I lost the job in the taqueria that I had been cooking in. And suddenly, no girl, no job. I had been living with this hippie who said, oh yeah, by the way, he'd been telling me Zen stories. I was like, that place you went to, where was that? He said, oh, it's up in the mountains. I said, I'm going, right? So I ended up starting formal, like serious practice. I moved into this Zen center for quite some time. Because of the hippie, because of losing the job, because of the girl, because of hitchhiking, because of art school, because of misery, right? Right? And it turns out, you know, 20 years later, I get the texts down from my bookshelf, and it says, you know, one of the proximal causes of the arising of faith is dukkha, suffering. This is great. It's where you begin your practice. You begin with suffering, and then you encounter the Dharma. So I began with suffering. Right, I was a miserable California teenager. And the conditions behind that were manifold, I'm sure. We could go back all the way, right? And so this process then, the early sages, they said, oh, this clearly is the case within this lifetime. It must be the case beyond this lifetime as well. And they asked, why are we here? Why is a certain person born a king and another one born a slave and another one born a mosquito? Right. If you're born a mosquito, it's very difficult to get out of being born a mosquito again, right? Because it's very difficult to do wholesome action, which is the thing that gets you born in a better life. So my teacher, Christopher Titmus, I was on retreat with him in India, where there are mosquitoes. And he said one night in his perfect, extraordinary sort of upper-class British accent, He said, oh, 10 million lifetimes as a mosquito. Right? You just keep coming back as the same thing. So the idea, and again, this is a tangent, but it's implied in the Hiranyakapa teachings, that the process of being in samsara, the endless round of birth and death, is a process of being caught by conditions. And those conditions are largely generated by our own actions. When we generate anger in reactivity and we cause harm, that harm pours forward into the next generation as a certain result. And we see this all around us, right? Even if you don't go for traditional, you know, this body to that body to that body reincarnation, although if you want to, you know, get a kombucha sometime, I'll try to argue you into it. I think it makes sense. Or in a different way, I'll say, I think that some of the teachings don't make sense without it. Stephen Batchelor doesn't agree with me. So I'm on the side of those who think that. But this teaching is tied into it because it says that it's my past actions that led to this life itself. And it's that my actions in this life that will lead to what happens in the next life. And that process is what we have to feel and in a certain way be terrified of in order to seek liberation, right? Because the Buddhist path isn't about, as Dan Harris says nowadays, becoming 10% happier, right? This is, you know, he seems like a very nice guy. But really, I don't want to become 10% happier. I want to become 100% happier. And the Buddha says over and over, don't settle for a lesser goal. Don't settle for just kind of muddling through your life a little bit less stressed. Go for, you know, go for the real brass ring, full liberation. And so then we get these teachings that say, reflect on the past, reflect on the future, and really orient toward goodness. Not just because it's good, but because it determines what will happen to you. It determines the conditions of your life in the future, both within this lifetime and perhaps beyond, right? If I act with goodness right now, it will absolutely determine the course of my son's life. I just had a baby. He's 4 months old. And as far as I can tell, there's no dukkha in his life yet, except when the Milky isn't right there when he wants it. Then for a moment, right, it's like, you know, you're killing me. He has this great scream that's really like full terror for, you know, and I'm like, no, really, you just have a fart. It's okay. And, you know, give him a little massage. And suddenly he's like, oh, I'm happy again. So he's a very simple creature so far. Complication will come. But even if we don't go to reincarnation, right, and we just think like the way a tree drops an acorn that grows into another tree, right? I have this son. He's a beautiful little butterball. But there's 10,000 ways that he will absorb from me any number of conditions, right? And some will be to his benefit and some won't be, because I think that's how it is. But it's absolutely clear that my actions in the ethical realm matter a great deal for his well-being. And then we can say, for the well-being of the planet going forward. So when the Buddha sits down to end this thing once and for all, he takes a meal from a woman named Sujata, who is then venerated as the first lay devotee. The first person ever to take refuge is Sujata. She was a wealthy woman from the town of Benares, and she had, in a year or two previous, she had come to the forest and prayed to a great tree spirit for a child and made offerings to the tree spirit. She went back to the town. She did, in fact, become pregnant and had a son, and when the baby was born healthy and was growing up, she went back to the forest to give an offering back to this tree spirit in gratitude. And the offering she was going to give was the milk of 1,000 cows that had been boiled down into a thick, extraordinarily nourishing substance, and then fed to 100 cows, who then their milk was boiled down into a precious substance and fed to 10 cows, so that the ultimate kind of extraordinary yogurt, perhaps, right, was this profoundly nourishing, almost kind of magical ritual substance, right? She gets to the tree and sees this radiant young man sitting underneath it. And she thinks perhaps this is the spirit of the tree, and she offers to him the food. So this is in the commentaries, the story of how the Buddha gets this meal. So she named her child Yasa. And we were told, my wife and I were told this story at an almsgiving ceremony at by the Bhikkhuni Ayatata Loka last year. And it was a beautiful story. My wife was pregnant, and she kind of wove in this whole thing about this great kind of mother and her son Yasa. So when it came time, our boy came out, and we had all these names picked out for him, and he wasn't any of them. We were like, "Oh, you're not that thing," and we were like, "How about Yasa?" So we named our child Yasa after Sujata's son, and also after Yasodhara, the Buddha's mother. So anyway, that's a tangent, but there you go. That's what I named my child. Sujata gives him this milk, and he sits down to practice, vowing not to get up until full liberation was reached. And we know the story of how in the first watch of the night, he's assailed by the mind of lust. And in the images, Mara, the great deceiver, who's in a way a descendant of the god of death, the word means death. Mara, the deceiver, comes and says, I'll distract the Blessed One from his quest. Mara doesn't like anyone to get enlightened because that means they leave his control. He controls all of us until you get free. So first Mara sends his beautiful daughters to dance and be sexy. And the Buddha acknowledges them in their sexiness and says, "That's not what I'm doing right now. Thank you very much." So they go away. They're like, "Oh, well," you know. And then Mara sends the flip side, right? He sends lust, and then he sends anger. He sends what are called the armies of Mara, demons with weapons coming in. There's marvelous pictures of this. All of these fearsome beasts and demons coming in to scare the Buddha and disturb his concentration. And they shoot all these arrows and throw spears and things. And it's said that when the spears and arrows come close to the Buddha, his goodness was giving off such a radiance that the spears and arrows just turned into flowers and rained down around him. Right? So next time you have an anger attack, just imagine, right, that it can't get to you, right? It's swirling around you, but it's actually just raining down as flower petals. And finally, Mara comes in himself with the killer of all meditators, doubt, and says, "Who do you think you are to become liberated? You can't do this. Nobody leaves my realm." And in response to ask for a greater force to bear witness to his eons of dedicated practice seeking freedom, the Buddha reaches down and touches the earth in the famous earth witness mudra, calling upon the goddess of the earth to bear witness to his practice and his right to exist, really. And it's said that the earth quakes and Mara dissolves and vanishes. In the Thai tradition, there's a variation of this myth that says that the earth goddess actually appears. She walks up out of the river where she's been bathing, which this is very nice, right? The sexy demons have left, and instead we get a bathing earth goddess, which, Still sounds pretty good to me. She comes up out of the river where she's been bathing, and she wrings out her hair, her long, long black hair that's wet. And the wringing out of her hair causes a flood that washes away all the demons. So, and of course, there's elements in this story that are earthy and ancient, really, right? Of a flood that washes away non-goodness. Interesting. And the fact that, you know, both the nourishment for his quest and the one who bears witness to him are both feminine figures, are both women, an earthly woman and a goddess. And with all of the distractions set aside, he then settles into his concentration. He walks his way through the jhanas and then settles into reflection on the cause of suffering. And what he reflects on is comes out as three insights. The first is the insight into his past lives. And he remembers his own past lives in their manifold, it says 1, 5, 10, 100, 1,000, 100,000, endless eons worth of past lives. He remembers where he lived, what he ate, for whatever reason, what he wore, what he did, how he passed away from that place, and how he reappeared in another place. The second of the insights is how beings, so all the rest of us, pass on in accordance with their actions. And then the third was looking directly at the cause of suffering itself, and he has the insight into dependent origination and is done. So I mentioned these insights in the context of Hiri and Ōtapa because the first two insights, like Hiri and Ōtapa, are a reflection on the past and the future. So the first thing he realizes is his own past. And he looks back into his own past actions through many, many lifetimes, and he sees, in essence, the course of both practice, so wholesome action, but then, of course, he's going to see his unwholesome actions as well, that led him to this point. And the whole course of karma, of unfolding cause and effect that led to this moment. So he reflects on the past. And having seen clearly the past, we can say part of what's woven into the teaching on see clearly your own past is to understand the causation or how things came about, right? Because of the stupid thing I said in that relationship, I tried to do better the next time. And more or less I did, right? It's not completely linear, but not too bad, right? One slowly matures over time. And so, you know, one looks back at one's past lives and sees, oh, this led to that, led to that, led to that, right? And with Hiri, that healthy conscience for the past or moral shame, the encouragement is see your own past as far back as you can know it and understand the effects of your actions. In his second insight, he sees the future. He sees how beings pass on in accordance with their actions. So given our present condition and the actions we choose to do now, what will happen based on that? Right? And one of the things the Buddha does throughout the text is he tells the monks where people have gone after they die. Somebody dies, and the monks go to the Buddha and say, where did they go? And the Buddha says, well, they were a stream enterer, so they went to the heaven realm, and they're going to come back and do this. Or the Buddha says, they, because of this terrible action they did, they're going to go to hell for a while, but then after that, they'll do some good deeds, and eventually they'll work their way back. He names the destination of people, and this is part of his divine eye, it's called, the eye of wisdom. And it's part of what comes from this second insight that he had, is he sees how actions pour forward in time into their results. And so Ōtapa, the fear of doing unskillful action, is really, it's the fear of, or the healthy caution around doing actions that may lead to painful result in the future. So then we have a weave here between, in some ways, a very simple ethical instruction to reflect on my actions, past and future. We have how that implies the whole teaching of karma, of how actions pour forward in time, creating the conditions for the next situation. And we have this reflected in one of the most important places in the myth or in the canon, right, on the very night of the Buddha's awakening, that he does this reflection for himself. He reflects on the past and future in relation to how actions unfold. So here's one place then that, so this, these qualities here in Ottapa, they show up in several lists. And I want to mention just a couple for completeness sake. One list that we perhaps hear about quite commonly, I heard about it many, many times, very commonly taught on retreats and in groups like this, is the list of the five faculties, the five spiritual faculties, which are faith and energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And these, when they get perfected, turn into the five spiritual powers, the bala, the strengths, profound faith manifesting as refuge, profound energy or rapture, uplifting energy, also perseverance, virya for practice, fire for practice, mindfulness as the balancing factor that governs the whole system, concentration or samadhi, the ability to stabilize the mind, and wisdom, seeing clearly. So we hear a lot about this list. There's a different list of five powers, and it's called the five powers of the trainee, or the one who's just beginning. And it's interesting, it's a parallel to the five spiritual faculties, except that it leaves out mindfulness and concentration, because you haven't developed them yet, is what I get from it. The powers of the trainee are faith and energy, and hiriya notapa, moral shame and moral dread, and wisdom. So the sense is that in the beginning of practice, one of your strengths or powers is the power of ethical reflection, right? And so like you've gone to become a monk or a nun, and one of the first things you can do long before you get great concentration and are visiting heaven realms due to the power of your jhanas or whatever, that one of the first things you can do is you can observe the rules of the order. You can take care of your own actions. You can be kind to others. And this becomes a power of the trainee, of the person in training. And so the list then is takes out these two qualities that are the results of development, mindfulness and concentration, and substitutes these kind of foundational qualities of conscience and concern. So here's one more place where these two qualities are, in a sense, the foundation of what comes next. And this is a passage from the Anguttara. So it says, imagine a tree devoid of branches and leaves. Its buds don't grow to maturity. Its bark doesn't grow to maturity. Its sapwood doesn't grow to maturity. Its heartwood doesn't grow to maturity. In the same way, when there being no mindfulness or alertness, a person is devoid of mindfulness or alertness, the prerequisite for a sense of conscience and concern, hiriya notapa, becomes spoiled. There being no sense of conscience and concern, the prerequisite for restraint of the senses is spoiled. There being no restraint of the senses, the prerequisite for virtue becomes spoiled. There being no virtue, the prerequisite for right concentration becomes spoiled. There being no right concentration, the prerequisite for knowledge and vision of things as they actually are is spoiled. There being no knowledge and vision of things as they actually are, disenchantment and dispassion is spoiled. There being no disenchantment and dispassion, knowledge and vision of release becomes spoiled. So this is a way of saying, here is a sequence of practice. This is a kind of a sequence that lists from basic qualities all the way through to full liberation. So without the metaphor of the tree and without the sort of linking what is devoid of, what the poetry. Here's just the list, right? So this is the list. The first quality, mindfulness. So in this list, mindfulness is first. And it says mindfulness and alertness, right? And I would actually have to look up a parallel translation, maybe I should, to know if that's sati sampajana, sampajana meaning full awareness. My guess is that it is, because they often come together, but I don't know without looking it up. Mindfulness and alertness, I'll go with this translation for now. There's the basic quality, and then based in that, conscience and concern, hiriya and otapa. So I have to be awake a little bit first, paying attention, in order to even notice what my actions are. Once I notice my actions, I have this reflection on past and future actions, conscience and concern. When there is conscience and concern, hiri and otapa, there can be restraint of the senses. Restraint of the senses. And this is the first practice that really turns both inward and toward the meditative qualities. So it's interesting, mindfulness and alertness, especially when there's alertness in that formula, there's a sense that the list starts with a kind of outwardness. I'm alert. I know where I am. I know what I'm doing. I'm aware of the whole situation. Based in that, there's reflection on ethical action. May my actions be for the good. May I be not perform actions that are not for the good. And then based in that, I can then withdraw the senses. And this sequence going from sila or ethical action to concentration appears many times through the texts. And one way it was explained to me and that makes sense to me having been a distracted meditator on retreat for so many years is that when past actions have been quite harmful to yourself or others, it's very, very difficult to concentrate. Right? It's not just that they're bad, right, or they caused harm. It's actually that you can't settle down, right? There I am sitting happily cruising away at my, you know, path to liberation, and my mind is like, you shouldn't have said that. Really, you shouldn't have said that. Oh, man, I wish I hadn't said that, you know? And, like, it was 20 years ago, and I'm still like, oh, you know? So that, right, that is a result of that unskillful action. That's an immediate, direct result in my mind stream of that unskillful action. Not to mention that the person I said it to might well be thinking the same thing. Why? Oh, man, that guy Sean, what a jerk. When he was 15, he said this bad thing to me, right? So at a certain point, I went to Burma to take robes, to become a monk and practice. And I was given the name there, protected by sila, sila rakita, protected by ethics. And I'd been there for many months, and I got a telegram that my mom was dying of cancer, and I came back to the States. I unmonked and came back to the States. And when I arrived, I got to be with her for about 10 days. I had a 10-day retreat with my mom at home before she passed away. And at a certain point, we were hanging out by the kitchen table, and I could sense that it was time for a conversation that we hadn't had in 30 years. And I said, but I'm not good at these kind of conversations. And so I just said, hey, Mom. And she was like, yeah. And I said, all that stuff I said, I'm sorry. I was just like, let's see if we can do this with a blanket apology and not go into specifics. All right? I was like, all that stuff, I'm sorry. And she said, oh, it's okay. All that stuff I did, I'm sorry too. And we forgave each other. It took about 2 minutes. And then we were like, oh, I guess that's it. And she died a couple of days later. And, you know, maybe it could have been a little broader of a conversation, but I think we did well, given a lot of pain under the bridge. And and my mind has been calm about it since. So, when there is conscience and concern, restraint of the senses is possible. Restraint of the senses supports virtue. Virtue supports right concentration. So restraint of the senses, right? not letting myself get deluded by sensory contact, that is going to protect me from further unskillful action, right? My unskillful action is behaving badly while dating. Restraint of the senses will protect me from this, especially if I'm a monastic, right? It better. So restraint of the senses supports virtue, virtuous action, because I'm not deluded. I'm not grasping or aversive to the objects of the senses. Virtue then supports right concentration, which is jhana. Right concentration supports the wisdom limbs, knowledge and vision of things as they actually are. Yatha bhuta jnana dasana, which is just really fun to say, so I like to say it. Knowledge and vision of things as they actually are, seeing clearly, this is what actually is here. This is the mind state, this is actions, this is the effects of actions. Right? This is what the Buddha saw in that third insight. He saw things as they really are. Knowledge and vision of things as they are gives rise to disenchantment and dispassion. Somebody later in the series should talk about disenchantment as a lesser talked about teaching. Because again, the word makes us be like, oh, dispassion. I don't want dispassion. I want a passionate California life. But dispassion, right? Letting go of the hooks, right? And then disenchantment and dispassion gives rise to knowledge, the knowledge and vision of release, of being finished. So one last thing to hint at, and then I haven't left much time for conversation, but we'll hear a little bit. Here's just a hint to think about. Otapa, dread for future unskillful action, the word implies that I'm afraid of causing future unskillful action, which to me implies that I am not entirely in control of my future actions, otherwise I'd be able to just intend not to do it. But it actually helps to generate a healthy fear of it, which to me suggests a recognition that habit and the force of conditions is stronger than I am. It actually suggests even more than that. It suggests that I am not particularly in control of it at all. So I actually think that otapa, a reflection on future action with a healthy sense of caution, indicates that I'm actually observing the whole process from a certain slight remove, and that slight remove indicates the truth of anatta, of selflessness, right? That I don't own all of my actions, even though the verse on equanimity says all beings are the owners of their actions, and you are, right? So don't use selflessness as an excuse to act poorly, right? I didn't do it, right? My kid is totally going to do this to me. He's 8 years old. He's going to be like, I'm going to be like, why'd you break that dish? He's going to be like, what self could break a dish? And I would be like, what self is grounded? I don't know. I'm not going to ground my kid, I promise. But you know, what self is being a smart aleck right now? But anyway, the hint that being cautious in relation to my own future actions indicates actually that my volitionality in relation to them is suspect. Right, that what I need actually is to be alert in relation to them, not just to decide not to do unskillful things. If it was that easy, we would all be unskillful. No, we would all be skillful easily. But instead, things keep happening that I wouldn't have intended. So what's that about? All right, so anything to finish? Here's a poem to finish. This is a poem that a deva, a female spirit, says, coming to the Buddha in the middle of the night to praise Hiriyan Otapa. She says this: respecting the teacher, respecting the Dhamma, and with fierce respect for the Sangha, respecting concentration, ardent, and with fierce respect for training, consummate in shame and compunction, deferential, respectful, incapable of decline, one is right in the presence of unbinding. One is right in the presence of unbinding. So, may we all be in the presence of unbinding.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.